Say, well, let me ask you a question. If your child came to you and described his or her marriage the way you're describing yours, what would you tell? What advice would you give your child?
Hi, my name is Mina Kim, your host of The Click Line. I've worked on Wall Street for over 14 years. Then I built out Orange Theory Fitnesses and sold them to a private equity firm. And upon that exit, started investing in women and minority startups, as well as advising women who are getting divorced with financial consulting and strategy. Welcome to the first Click Line podcast. And I have an amazing guest, Jacqueline Newman, who is a matrimonial attorney in New York City. She's a managing partner of Berkman, Bakker, Newman, and Shine. She specializes in complex, high net worth matrimonial cases and negotiating prenup agreements. You've seen her everywhere. She's been on ABC, CBS, New York Times, CNBC, Glamour. The list goes on and on. She is also an adjunct professor at Cardoza School of Law, teaching divorce processes. She's been a super lawyer, listed as one of the top 100 attorneys in New York City. And because she has extra time, she's also author of a book, The New Rules of Divorce, 12 Secrets to Protecting Your Wealth, Health, and Happiness. She is a badass matrimonial attorney. Jacqueline, thank you for being here with us today.
Thanks so much for having me in that amazing introduction.
You need me everywhere now, right?
Exactly.
So I'd love to hear, and for everyone listening, for you to talk a little bit about your practice, each of the areas that you practice in, and what the differences are in each of those areas.
Sure. So, as you stated, I'm a matrimonial attorney, and our law firm does exclusively matrimonial. That's all we do all day long. And we do what I say. There are three ways to get divorced. There's mediation, collaborative law, and litigation. And our firm does all three. So as I say, you know, if you were somebody that thought that you may or may not want to litigate, but you go to a litigator, they're going to say, you need to litigate. And if you went to a mediator, they'd say, oh, you need to mediate, and et cetera, with a collaborative lawyer as well. And for us, it's really whatever the process choice works best for you. I always joke, my hourly rate's the same no matter what you choose. So most people have heard of mediation. Mediation is where you work with one person who's a neutral. The parties are usually in the room with the mediator, and sometimes they'll have their attorneys with them. Most often not. Most often they have attorneys on the outside that are advising them. When I work in the mediation capacity, to me, it's super important that people have attorneys because, again, I'm acting as a neutral. And so therefore, you want somebody who's going to be looking at it from the vantage point of that specific party. Mediation is a great process if you are able to do it. It's a voluntary process. And so you need to be somebody, you know, that wants to ultimately engage in something like that. It's self-selecting, so not right for everyone. But you know, one of the things I think that's most challenging about mediation for people that do it is you have to truly own your decision. And I think, you know, when people choose litigation, they have a judge that's going to tell them how it's going to go. As opposed to in a mediation process or any process where you ultimately make the decision as a party, you have to own it. And that takes a lot. So mediation, as I said, it's a great process. I usually encourage my clients to at least give it a shot. The worst thing is you spend a couple hours with the mediator, waste a little time. But if you're able to resolve custody, if you're able to resolve anything financial, any of that stuff is going to be so much more helpful to get that out of the way before you might move into, say, a litigation stance.
It's sometimes with mediations, you're able to use a judge as well, right, to mediate?
So that's not mediation. What you're thinking probably is arbitration. So in arbitration, you may be able to bring a judge in, and that person can act in that capacity. It would be a private judge as opposed to possibly, you know, going to a traditional court. But mediation, it's very important for people to understand that. And I'm really glad you brought that up because I do think that's a common, you know, confusion. Mediation is, again, the mediator is not a judge. And so, you know, people always want you to be a judge and they always look to you and say, well, what do you think and what should we do? And I say, that's not my role. My role is to be neutral and to ultimately facilitate you two coming to a decision. So very different than arbitration. Arbitration falls more into the litigation category where you're having somebody else make the decision for you. So I can talk a little bit about that. Arbitration is a, you know, as I said, I would say that on the branch of the litigation arm. But to move on to collaborative law. So a lot of times people may say, you know, mediation sounds great, but I need an attorney in the room. I feel I'm not as financially sophisticated as my spouse. I feel my spouse is manipulative. Everybody's spouse is a narcissist, all of that. So ultimately in a situation where somebody may say, I need protections in the room. And that's where collaborative law can walk in. So collaborative law is where you enter into a process saying that you are not going to go to court. So it's a huge push on settlement. Collaborative attorneys go through a ton of training. And basically, you're in a situation where you are in the room with your attorneys. It also could be an interdisciplinary approach where you can bring in a divorce coach, which is a therapist trained to ultimately help facilitate communication. You could bring in a child specialist applicable, and you can bring in a financial neutral. You know, I always say it's a team sport, and I'm the most expensive player on the team, so why wouldn't you work with all these other people? The catch to collaborative law is that, again, it's voluntary. However, if the process breaks down, you cannot use those same attorneys in litigation. And that's a big, you know, that's a big thing. So for an example, if I'm working with somebody and, you know, I think we're getting along great and everything's going fantastic, and then all of a sudden the spouse says, you know what, I don't want to do collaborative anymore. At that point, not only am I out, my entire firm is out and the person has to start all over. So that is really what kind of is the big push on this. And the theory behind it is you want everyone committed to the settlement. If people think that, you know, it doesn't really matter if we settle, I'm going to represent this person in court anyway, then you're not going to be as committed to the process. So that's collaborative. Again, it's a great process. I also say if you can't do mediation and you feel like you want, you know, a little bit more structure, fantastic process. And then there's the third, which I would say is litigation. So, you know, I do a lot of litigation. I don't want to sit and say it's the worst thing in the world, but I will say that if you can avoid being in court, most people should. There are many reasons you might need to be in court. It strategically could be very smart for you to litigate, but it's a hard process. It's a hard process. It's a long process. It's emotionally expensive. It's financially expensive. Not to say that the other ones are cheap by any means or not emotionally expensive, but litigation is very, very difficult. And to the point I was making before, when you're litigating, you are handing these incredibly important decisions about your family, about your money, about your future into the hands of somebody that's going to see 40 or 50 cases that day. And they're not going to know the nuances of your life, and they don't have time for the nuances of your life. And, you know, I always say, like, you know, it's kind of like someone's a butcher and they'll just slice it as opposed to someone who's going to sculpt, you know? And so that's really the way you need to look at both of these process choices. And to your point, arbitration would fall more into that thing. That's when people want to hire private judges to make decisions in the same capacity that they would be in a litigation, except there's a big controversy about whether you can actually appeal from those decisions. And in most situations, you probably cannot.
Got it. Thank you for clarifying. So for mediation, we think about it as two people are agreeing or more amicable. They're coming to a neutral third party. They have attorneys in the background, but the attorneys aren't in the mediation with them. Is that the right way to think about it?
It is. I think it's the right way as a typical framework. There are times that people will bring their attorneys to mediation. You know, as the mediator, I don't always love that because it adds to the dynamic of, you know, advocacy in the way that you have, you know, usually the attorneys end up talking most of the time. And so sometimes, you know, the part of the process, and I think part of the ownership is having it be about the parties, but sometimes people need that. And, you know, sometimes what I'll do is I may have the parties for the first session and then they bring their attorneys the second session. So, you know, I will say the benefit of that, though, is one of the worst things that can happen in a mediation is that you have somebody who just really wants out. They kind of don't care and they just want to say yes, yes, yes to their spouse because they just want to be done. And then they go to their attorneys and the attorney says, what are you doing? Like, you can't give this person 95% of the assets. Like, I know you want out, but don't do that. And so then what ends up happening is that person comes back to mediation and says, well, you know I said I'd give 95% of the assets and in exchange you'd give me the cat. But now I'm deciding, you know what, I can't do that. My attorney said no. And I always think of mediation as like there, every deal that happens is like bricks on a wall. And if somebody comes back and pulls a brick right from the bottom, the whole wall crashes down. And so to me, when you have attorneys in the room, the one benefit is that they can't then pretend that they went back to their attorney and their attorney said something because everybody's there. So that could be a benefit of that process.
Right. Got it. And so what percentage of your practice would you say is in those three categories? Like, what's the percentage breakdown?
Oh, I would say the only other thing that I do personally is I do a ton of prenuptial agreements. So for my personal practice, I would say I'm probably 40% prenups and the rest is really one of those models. And right now I happen to be doing much more litigation than I want to be. So I would probably say at this moment, it's more the litigation. But I actually do want to make one point, though, is that people, when I say litigation, it doesn't necessarily mean you're seeing in the inside of the courtroom. It just means it's not usually mediation or collaborative. So you can have the traditional model where you have the attorneys that are negotiating, and you may settle your case with your attorneys that without seeing the inside of a courtroom. So that is, you know, that would fall more, I'd say, into the litigation, you know, pile, because it's not ultimately collaborative or mediation. But I do want to make that point. I don't want everyone to think that they have to see the inside of a courtroom to get divorced.
Right. Yes. No, that's great to clarify. And talking about prenups, often people think of prenups that it's only people with trust funds or who are ultra high net worth individuals do. What would you say to that?
I'd say it's kind of ironic. I agree with you. I think that that is what most people think. And the ironic part of it is that the people that are incredibly wealthy, the wealthy families, they have estate planning, like you just said. They have trusts. They actually don't need a prenup. And it always kind of amazes me when you have these families that come to us and they basically have nothing in their estate because they are, you know, completely done estate planning 100% properly. And, you know, especially if you have somebody who isn't going to necessarily earn a ton of money, but because they're going to be living off their trust money and that sort of circumstance, you know, they actually don't need it at all. And, you know, the story I often told, and I know you and I spoke a little bit about this, is my puppeteer story, which, you know, it was one of those situations where I represented somebody who had a very household name, we'll say, came from a family of old money. And this gentleman, really, really sweet guy, he was, you know, very educated, all Ivy League schools, you know, up the wazoo, again, basically an alphabet after his name. But he loved puppeteering. And so he was a puppeteer. And, you know, when he came to me, I joked about I've never met a real puppeteer before, but this was his passion. And being that he had the financial means to follow his dreams, as opposed to what, you know, people with a different last name may have to go out and actually earn lots and lots of money, he didn't have that. So, yeah, he would do children's birthday parties. He would do he'd do it in the park. Like, he would do these things. And he made maybe about, I think he made maybe $20,000 a year. And he was marrying a school teacher. And his family was, of course, like, oh, we need a prenup. And, you know, this was kind of the funny part about it is that actually he really didn't, because all the money that supported their lifestyle was coming from trusts. The trust owned their apartment. The trust gave them all their money. The trust paid for everything. They would go to vacation homes on vacations. Like, it was all family stuff. And the $20,000 he was earning, that was going into the marital pot for whatever that's worth. And the wife also, you know, her income was not substantial. And so we're in this situation where, you know, this prenuptial agreement did give her, you know, I would say a sizable, you know, what we call a distributive award, which is a lump sum you can receive upon a divorce. And it was way more than what would be in the marital pot. So the attorney on the other side was trying to ask for more and more and more. And I kept saying, I was like, at the end of the day, my client is actually better off not even doing a prenup because there's no marital money. And I said, and the fact that your client's getting as much as she's getting, she should say thank you and walk away. I said, because he doesn't even need this. He just thinks he does, or his family thinks he does. But when you talk it through, and no matter how many times I kind of explained to them, you don't really need this, they still insisted that they needed it. And that is kind of the irony. And when you move it, when you marry into somebody that has, you know, a family that has a lot of money, you need to think about, well, there are definite nice things about it, and odds are your children's colleges and private school is going to get paid. But there are times that someone may not, you know, ultimately create a marital pot that will need to be, you know, that will be contributed. And so you can actually be in a less favorable position upon a divorce if marrying into a wealthy family, as opposed to marrying into somebody that may earn money throughout the marriage and build a career throughout the marriage that creates the marital pot that somebody would receive a part of upon a divorce.
Yeah, super interesting. Yeah. And so when people come to you for the prenup, what are some things that you wish they addressed beforehand that you, like, common issues that you see when they're coming finally to do a prenup after being engaged for a year, dating for 5 years, whatever it is?
So that's a hard question because there's lots of things I'd like them to talk about. And, you know, I know your podcast is not 10 days long, so
we can make it 10 days.
So look, I think that, you know, one of the first things that I see as a big issue is that money means a lot of different things to different people. And so I wish they would have real conversation about conversations about what money means to them. Because you have certain people that may look at it as, you know, a source of food and like actual survival. And then you'll have other people that look at it as a source of fun. And other, you know, everybody just has their different ways. If you're a spender, if you're a saver, just whatever your money philosophy is, I wish they would have these conversations before, while they're dating, and then ultimately before they come to me for a prenuptial agreement. So that is where I think, you know, and obviously that spurs into different issues, but that general premise, if people were on the same page about money and also had a good sense of the financial situations of everyone, because the other thing that happens in a prenuptial agreement is you have full financial disclosure. And so you have to tell each other what you have. And so sometimes I've seen a lot of situations where on both ends, one, where there's a lot more debt that the other person didn't know about, and that can cause a lot of feelings of mistrust. And then there may be a lot more money that they didn't know. And, you know, I had a case not that long ago where I represented the moneyed spouse, and he, you know, was very wealthy, but he was, to be honest, very cheap. And he, with his fiance, was very, very cheap with her. And then he didn't want to show her how much he had because he knew she'd be mad. And sure enough, she was furious. And she said, you know, why are you nickel and diming me? I mean, she was paying him rent in his apartment, like all these things, which, you know, again, whatever you want to do is fine, but he made it seem like he had no money. And then when she saw the numbers, she was really, really angry. And so that was not a good situation. But so you have situations like that where, again, people should be talking about these things. And I know a lot of people feel money is a little dirty and it's like a taboo subject, but it's not. You know, it's the way the world goes round, and you're marrying this person. So you should be able to have all these types of conversations. So that's one, you know, kind of overarching thing. If you want more specific things, I think that when you have somebody that has a business, and we deal with a lot of business cases, you want to have conversations about, you know, what you want to do about that business. Is that business going to be marital property? Is the appreciation of the business going to be marital property? Is it not going to be marital property? What you do when you have people that have such income disparities, you know, just start having these conversations. What are people's expectations? You know, are you expecting to continue to work or not work? And again, you never really know. You may have a child that may have special needs. There may be reasons why you may not be able to work to the same degree that you are anticipating, but have that conversation. I mean, many times I have people that assume, you know, that one spouse assumed the other spouse was going to work, and then the other spouse says, no, as soon as I'm having a child, I'm done. And they're like, wait, that's not the plan. And you want to have that. It's all about, I mean, you know, another question I'm asked very often is, you know, what causes divorce? And I think it's failed expectations. And so I think being clear about your expectations of the marriage when it comes to money, relationships, sex, children, anything, communication is just key on all of that, because that is what causes the resentment and the anger and people having to use the prenuptial agreement that we were hoping they'd never have to use.
Right, exactly. And speaking about the discrepancy in earnings, a lot of, as you know, I also provide financial strategy consulting for high net worth individuals who are going through divorce or after their divorce, and helping them set up for their financial future. And oftentimes, you know, they were the stay-at-home mom who took care of the two or three kids and don't have access or don't even know how much money is in the bank. For people in that type of situation and they're thinking about divorce, what type of information or what are the first steps that you would advise them on in trying to figure out their situation and their financial picture?
So that does happen a lot. I call it being in the financial dark. And sometimes people choose to be in the dark, and that's, you know, a choice you make. And there are other people that don't have a choice, but it's just kind of the role that they may have been designated in the marriage. You know, maybe one person just said, I'm going to take care of this and not share information. So, and I will say, just on a side note before I answer your question directly, that can cause a lot of shame and embarrassment when people come to me and they say, I honestly have no idea how much I spend. I have no idea what's, you know, what anyone's income is. I have no idea, you know, what the assets are. And I say to people all the time, like, look, don't walk in with shame on that. It's a fact and we'll figure it out. But I feel like some people just don't even want to tell me that. And I am always just like, I need to know everything. And so while I can understand it may feel badly about it, you're going to learn for the next time. And now you're going to start learning now. And that's okay. You know, again, everybody right. has their role sometimes in marriages. And, you know, and there's no shame in that. So I just want to throw that out to your listeners right away that you should be yes. forthcoming about it. And it is what it is. And we're going to figure it out. And to answer your question on how you figure it out. So you know, look, I say that to the degree that you can, you know, if there's a statement sitting on the kitchen table that, you know, is a bank statement, take a picture of it. Like, try as much as you can to gather as much information as you can. If you do not have it and do not have access to it, and I don't want anyone hacking into anyone's phones or computers, do not do that. We'll get it. I mean, at the end of the day, part of the process of a divorce is that you would go through full financial disclosure, as we discussed previously, even in the divorce or in a prenuptial agreement. Clients will fill out what's called a statement of net worth, where they have to list all of their assets. It's a sworn statement. So that's kind of where it all begins. We can also do discovery, where we can ask for bank statements, basically at the beginning of the marriage, if we want. We will figure it all out and we will find it. And if you're really concerned about hiding money, which I tell people all the time, it's much harder to hide than people think it is. But if someone is really that masterful and has been planning this for long enough and they can really hide money, or if they happen to be in a cash business, then they might be able to, we can hire private investigators. We can hire forensics. Like, there are always ways to figure it out if we have to. But it's hard, you know, it's one of those things. It's not easy to hide money, and we will find it. So I want the people that are in that position to gather as much information as they can, but not to beat themselves up about it.
Right. And so one of the other issues that I encounter is that since they don't have access to the large bank accounts, they may not have, let's say, ready cash available to pay for legal retainer fees, because sometimes the retainer fees are quite high. So how do they go about kind of managing that in the meantime?
So it's a good question. Every firm is different. You may have certain firms that may take the non-moneyed spouse and then ultimately make a motion to be paid their retainer. I will be honest, my firm does not do that. My firm does say that, you know, people can pay on credit card, they can borrow money. There's a lot of different ways people can obtain the fees for retainers. But yeah, it's challenging, you know, and when people come to me in advance wanting to get divorced and they're just kind of going for that informational session and they don't have access to funds themselves, my recommendations is generally like start opening credit cards, start, you know, siphoning a little bit just to have some money, because while it's kind of an immature move to cut somebody off, I'm not going to tell you people don't do it. And it's just very important for people to have access to their own money, because it will still be marital money. But if you don't have access to it, to your point, you can be very limited during the divorce process. And there are people out there that will loan money to people in divorce. I mean, there are things that can be done. There, you know, their interest rates are crazy and it's not really the greatest, you know, situation always. But if you're desperate, you would do it. But yes, having some money in your own name is an important thing. And as I said, I'm sure there are some firms out there that may take people and, you know, take a very small retainer with the idea being that they'll get the payment, you know, later on.
Yeah. And I'm glad you brought up opening your own credit too, because I found that a lot of people, you know, you've been married for 20, 30 years, you're on the spouse's credit cards, so you don't even have your own credit going, you don't have your own bank accounts. So I encourage everyone to go and build your own credit. Because an important stat, too, is women in their 50s is the largest demographic of first-time home buyers. And if you haven't been building your credit this time, that is more difficult for you to get a mortgage. So I think it's very important for everyone to take ownership of your credit and your money and your financial future. It's really important. Even if you think you don't need it right now, you should always have your own credit going and making sure that your numbers are good and your credit is free and clear.
I would absolutely agree with that.
Yeah. And so what about when a debt that's acquired during marriage, like all of a sudden your spouse decided they want to go to law school and now there's a couple hundred thousand in debt, and then there's all of a sudden your spouse decides they love buying really expensive things and they're accruing lots of credit card debt and most of it isn't yours. So does the court system really look at that when they're dividing up assets?
So I hate to do an answer like this. This is such a lawyer answer, but yes and no. On some level, courts, there's a lot of discretion in it. So we'll start with that. But let's take your example of spending a lot. You know, you do get that a lot. You get a lot of times where you have somebody that may even have spent throughout the marriage. And eventually the other spouse is saying, you know, you need to stop spending. We need budgets, blah, blah, blah. And it's like usually it's a big source of fights in the marriage. However, what ends up happening is that, unfortunately, a lifestyle gets established. So let's say someone's been doing this for, say, 5 years. They're fighting about it every time the credit card statement comes in. And then fast forward, now they're getting divorced. And now let's say I have the moneyed spouse who's saying, well, I've been telling him or her to stop spending for the last 5 years. But now you're going to tell me that this is now their lifestyle. Was I supposed to just not pay a credit card bill or like take that away from them? And I completely understand that concern. Unfortunately, assuming that there's enough income to support this type of thing, it does establish a lifestyle. And so a court is not going to say that somebody who may have been, you know, I'm not even going to say overspending, but maybe spending in a way that the other spouse doesn't agree with, like on extravagant, you know, clothing, gifts, things like that. That a court's not going to look at. They're not going to say, well, that's marital waste. If they're spending it on drugs, if they're spending it on gambling, if they're spending it on extracurricular relationships, we'll say, that could be seen as marital waste. So that court's done. They say no to that. But the rest of it, they're really not going to say much about. So you're not going to be in those situations. If somebody accumulates debt that's associated with possibly a school loan or something like that, that's a little trickier. Because it sort of depends. Like if somebody, you know, New York used to value licenses. So if you had a law license, a court would value it. And then it was much easier to say, okay, well, we're going to value your law license, but then we're also going to accumulate the debt. And so that was where it was easier to subtract. New York no longer does that, but we do still value like law offices or firms or businesses. And so I had a case similar to what you're talking about where my client opened a law practice and had law school loans. And so I was representing the wife who had done this, and the husband in this case was making this argument that the law school loans were hers and he wanted to value the business. And I said, no, you can't do both. Like you either, you know, if you're taking the good, you got to take the bad with it. And so that's where things go. But, you know, you kind of fight about it. And, you know, you definitely have people that may be in public service and they're not earning, you know, nearly as much as their law school debt may be. And so it's just one of those things. Courts, you know, they handle it as they want. There are cases that say a court's not going to go backwards and really start, you know, second guessing decisions that were made during the marriage. But if there's a significant law school loan and somebody is ultimately going to be earning in the future based on their law school, I can see that being argued that maybe it should be a little bit more on their side of the ledger. But hard to know.
Right. Okay. And so when you're talking about lifestyle, the lifestyle calculation, is this what is often referred to as kind of the one-year look back, where from the point that you file and looking back a year to see how much is spent to kind of come up with the calculation of what your lifestyle expenses are?
So I'm not going to say yes and no, but I'm going to say no and yes. So the way it works, at least I'll speak into New York. So there is a formula, and what you're referring to is spousal support, and we call it alimony, maintenance, spousal support. It's all the same thing. In New York, we usually call it maintenance. So what a court will do is they will look at the formula for spousal support or maintenance, and they look at it up to a cap. At this moment, the cap is $228,000. So I can tell you, most people that are living in New York City are earning probably in excess of $228,000 because that basically pays for Ubers to get back and forth in traffic. So as unfortunate as that is. So usually people's incomes are very often they're much higher than that. And that's when we get into the lifestyle analysis. So if your income is over and above the statutory cap, then the formula really doesn't apply. And then you start getting into lifestyle. And that's when you say the year look back. It's typically, you know, you don't always go back a year. You may make arguments to go back further or other things. Like, for an example, this year idea got really challenging, we'll say, during COVID, because we had this situation where people weren't vacationing, they weren't going out to eat, all these different things were happening. And so I had cases that started before COVID where, you know, and then maybe ended after COVID, but now you also had children that if you had a 5-year-old and now they're 7 or, you know, almost 8, you're going to do very different activities with a 5-year-old than you might with an 8-year-old. Now you could be going to better vacations. You could be doing things, you know, same thing with like a 1-year-old and even a, you know, a 3 or 4-year-old. So it really changed a lot. And it kind of skewed our whole look back situation. So now we're probably in a position where I would make a little bit more of the 1-year look back argument. But sometimes you really have to go further and you have to see like what makes sense and what was going on in everyone's lives. But it is, you know, it's really capturing the lifestyle of what's happening at that time. But again, you have to kind of use some metric, and therefore usually it is about a year.
Right. Okay. Yeah, that's an interesting point about COVID, because I know a lot of people did file during COVID too.
Yes, so. No, I was pretty popular during that stage of life.
Yeah, I'm sure. And so what about, you know, one of the main assets in a marriage is a house. And so if the house is under both of your names, now do you have to sell it, or can one just be transferred over, or do you have to go through a whole refinancing, et cetera? Because that really does affect your finances when you're going from, let's say, 3% rate that you were able to capture years ago, and now it's at 8%. That's a drastic monthly payment. So how does that get recalculated and shuffled around?
So you're right. I mean, this is one of the biggest challenges, and especially most people, their largest asset is more often than not real estate. So in situations like that, it can be a few different things. You can sell it, to your point. You know, people are getting nervous now about selling. You know, I'm getting a lot of people, especially in the high-end market, that are looking to unload quickly because they're nervous about recessions. They're nervous about all sorts of things. So I feel like that's been happening in a few of my cases right now. So I'm watching that. And they also are scared, obviously, of interest rates. So you have that on one hand. So selling is obviously always somewhat of an option. Very often people don't want to sell because you may have young children, you may feel it's too much disruption, you may just love your house. So you can have a buyout in that sort of circumstance where one party, assuming that there's the finances to do it, can buy out the other. Now, again, to your point, the issue about the refi is important because the interest rates are very, very different. So we've gotten a little creative with that. There are times that we just say refinance and you have to deal with it, and that's not great. There are other times where we've had people stay on the mortgage. Like I have actually a case right now where my client is buying out the apartment and the husband is going to stay on the mortgage because, to your point, they have a very low interest rate. He's going to stay on it, but the child support payments he'd be paying to her, he's going to pay directly as mortgage payments. So that way he's securing himself and he's not looking to buy anything. He's already got a vacation home. He's not looking to buy anything right now. So he's not as worried about his credit. And so we're just kind of getting creative. And then I want to say that I feel like they only have a couple of, like, maybe 5 or 6 more years left, and it happened to coincide when the child's going to be leaving. So she'll either sell at that point or she'll have to get them off the mortgage. So yeah, we just have to get creative because you're right. It is a big deal, and it's, you know, and when you didn't have interest rates as high as they are right now, you know, I practiced when the rates were reversed and people might have had high lows and then they were going lower. So that was a much easier market to be working in. But now we're obviously on the other end of that.
Yeah. And this is why it's so important for people listening to have the right attorney and team in place, because these types of creative solutions, you want your team to work through and be able to know and work with you in detail about your specific situation. So that's why it's so important to have the right team, including accountant, therapist, wealth manager, all of them. I'm going to talk to all of them, but especially your matrimonial attorney who's going through this process with you. And so what are some advice that you give post-divorce to your clients as they're sailing out into the sunset?
So post-divorce, you know, to be weary of their finances and to be very, very knowledgeable of their finances. A lot of times, you know, going back to what we were originally speaking about, when someone may be in the financial dark throughout most of their marriage, money can be scary. And even if you have it, it still feels scary. So I think education is so important. And that's why, to your point, you know, working with a good financial person is incredibly important. I think having, you know, I agree with you, having a team in place is crucial, especially if you're not comfortable with finances, then you need to meet someone you're comfortable with who is comfortable with finances. I think it's, you know, so that would be one thing, is to really, you know, be aware of it and become educated and become empowered. I think that it's, you know, one of the things I love most about my job is when I have somebody who comes to me in the beginning and isn't particularly empowered in whatever avenue of their lives. And throughout the divorce process, I really watch them become stronger. And that is, there's nothing more fulfilling than when someone, you know, goes off into the sunset, to your point, and is a really strong person and ready to kind of take things on independently. It's just, it's a wonderful thing to see. So I would say that. I think self-care is really important. I tell people, you know, again, going through a divorce is incredibly emotionally exhausting and traumatic. And, you know, people can tend to be very narcissistic in their divorce process because your world is blowing up. And so you take the time and you really kind of heal afterwards. I think it's just, you know, people may think I'm divorced and I'm done, and that's just not true. There's a lot that goes on in the process. It's a very, you know, it can be a drawn out process. You know, there's decisions that are made fast. There's just a lot that happens. And so when you finally get the calm, which hopefully people do get afterwards, you know, I really stress for them to your point with therapy and everything else, just to kind of process what they went through and really be able to kind of digest it and see it as, you know, the process that it actually was versus maybe how they envisioned it during the time. And also to learn from it and to grow from it and be stronger for possibly your children and everything else. You know, and the last one I would say is that, you know, when it's over, I think it's just very important for people to let go of a lot of like the anger and bitterness and all the stuff they carried around with them throughout probably right. their marriage and then definitely usually through their divorce. It's just toxic. It doesn't help you. And, you know, one of the things that, you know, when people ask me, well, how can you do what you do? I say that I really do believe that people come to me in unhealthy relationships and I open them up to be in healthier ones. And so in order for you to be in a healthy relationship after a divorce, you need to become healthy. And part of becoming healthy, I think, is really letting go of a lot of it. And, you know, especially if there are children involved, you want your kids to feel comfortable in both homes. You want them to feel secure in everybody's relationships and everybody's love. And, you know, carrying around a lot of anger doesn't help that. So, and children are incredibly perceptive. I say that all the time. They know what's going on. They say babies in the womb know what's going on from a stress perspective. So really letting it go and let it be true to you, I think will just do wonders for your children and then for you and then for hopefully the next person you're in a relationship with.
Yes, absolutely. I totally believe in that. In all aspects of life, the way that your energy is vibrating, it's what you welcome in. So you can't welcome in the next step without releasing, you know, things like bitterness and anger in your life. So I'm a big believer in that. And I've seen it happen where people totally blossom into the next level in their life. And it's amazing to see. And so with that said, what has been the most rewarding or some of the most rewarding cases that you've worked on?
So I'll bring it back to the, you know, watching people strengthen. And so I have like two very fun ones because they were happy endings to some degree. So I had one client who she was married for a very long time, probably like 30 plus years. She had two sons who were, I want to say maybe in their teens and early 20s. Actually, no, they must have been in their early 20s. This was many years ago. And her husband was a businessman, and he used to belittle her. I mean, it was just horrible the way he spoke to her. He truly couldn't understand. She wanted to get divorced. He couldn't understand why she'd want to get divorced. He literally said once in court, "I don't beat her and I feed her, so I'm not sure what she's complaining about." And that is how he saw things. Like, that was it. The two, as long as you don't do those two things, he's like, "You're a fantastic husband." So suffice it to say, she was divorcing him. And so one of the things that this woman had a magical touch in that everything she touched was pretty. She would make these like really extravagant, like Christmas dinners and holiday dinners. And like, you know, I remember she showing me pictures of her Christmas tree, and it was just, I mean, it was gorgeous. Like, I mean, the stuffs that this woman would do, just everything was pretty. Her house was beautifully decorated. And he would like just poo-poo all of that. Like, he'd be like, "Why are you spending so much money on this?" He's like, "Nobody cares." He's like, "You know, that's not pretty anyway. That's over the top." Like, he would just constantly knock her down for everything she would do. And she took such joy in this, like such, I mean, you could see her eyes light up when she would talk about this. And she'd show me pictures. I mean, it's like, you know, when people show pictures of their dogs, she would show me pictures of like her, you know, table all set and stuff. Like, she was just so proud. So while we were sitting in court one day, and, you know, you sit around in court all the time and just wait, we were talking about what would be her next steps, you know, once she eventually got divorced. And we were talking about, you know, and of course, you know, her self-esteem was so low. She's like, "Oh, I can't do anything. You know, there's nothing I can do that would be good." And, you know, like really just her self-esteem was nothing. And that's what got us talking. I said, "Well, what do you love to do?" And so she started talking to me about all these pictures and blah, blah, blah. And I said, "Well, how can we build that into something? Like, what can we do? Like, take the things you love." when she was going to be in a financially strong position because there was a good amount of money in the case, I said, money's not going to be your motivator. So what is it that you're going to love? And so ultimately, you know, throughout all these talks and stuff, she decided that she was going to start throwing tea parties, you know, high tea parties for young children. And she was going to like make, you know, how pretty is that? Like she would make, you know, all the tables so, cool. pretty, and she would make all the little cute little sandwiches and the whole thing. So she started doing it. She had like a little parlor part of her house. And so she started doing it out of that. And then sure enough, it grew, which didn't shock me at all. And she ended up getting, you know, some extra places. And then she opened one in the city and she ended up being incredibly successful. Ultimately,
amazing.
She came into my office like probably about a year later, just finished up some paperwork. And she comes in this like long, you know, mink coat, which, you know, I have my own feelings on that, but we'll put that to the side. And she looked fantastic. And she tells me that she's earning more than he did, the husband,
wow.
in this business. And the other thing that was so fantastic
about
this,
her.
And she stood taller. I mean, I said, like, were never this tall. I was like, you know, and of course she was also wearing like this, you know, Louboutin heels this big. But I said, you know, I was like, you could just feel it in her. But the other thing that was so great about this is that she had these two sons who watched the way that the father treated her whole life. And they treated her that way too. They really belittled her and everything. And then she becomes this successful businesswoman. And the boys ended up working with her. And we're running some of the business stuff. And one was doing the marketing. And it was like the success story of that, to watch this woman blossom into the thing that he mocked, that ultimately ended up being more successful, the love she had of it. And to watch her children, her boys, see their mother and a woman, you know, be able to grow and really take whatever her passions were and make it grow. Because my big concern was like, how are these boys going to treat their wives? Like how are they going to treat their daughters? What is their dynamic? And I can tell you that experience shifted it. So not only did it do something for the client, my client, but it also did something for her grandchildren and her sons and generations to come. And so to me, watching that was just amazing. And I'm so proud of her. And, you know, and I reached out to her and my daughter. I was going to have one of my daughter's birthday parties at her place. It didn't end up working out, but I was like, I don't even know if I can afford you anymore.
Oh my God. I love that story. That's so amazing. And it really speaks to also the women out there who are thinking, oh, you know, I'll wait till the kids go to college. They don't really think there's much of a difference right now, and there's a lot of people thinking that way, but they do. Kids are very, very smart. They're very in touch with, you know, the vibe and the feeling and then the environment in the house, and it does affect them. So I love hearing that story because it's multi-level, you know, glow up for everybody, the sons and her. Yeah, I love that.
Right. Well, and I want to just pick up on what you're saying because it is so super important. I do have so many people that say, we're just going to wait till college. And I say, and that's fine. You know, everybody has to make their choice. However, they are role modeling, whatever their marriage dynamic is being role modeled for their children. And so when I have a client come in and, well, especially when there's, you know, emotional abuse, like physical abuse, I feel like everyone knows you don't stand for that. Emotional abuse can be much more disguised. And so when I'm watching this and clients will talk to me about it, and men and or women, by the way, this is not necessarily always a female, you know, edge thing. Women can be pretty difficult too. But I would say this, I say all the time, you know, when they're like, well, I don't know, blah, blah, blah. And I say, well, let me ask you a question. If your child came to you and described his or her marriage the way you're describing yours, what advice would you give your child? Would they stay in the marriage or not? And I said, because whatever advice you give your child is what your grandchild is seeing, you know, and it's the same thing. And again, I'm so into like breaking cycles and all of that sort of thing. And, you know, it says what, 3 generations to break a cycle or whatever it is. And I want to start now, you know, on a lot of these cycles. And so it really is an eye-opening thing because most of my clients will be like, I would never want my daughter to be in this relationship or my son. And I said, well, you know, think about that. What does that mean? You know, and so I do think it's just very, very important. And, you know, one of the things people say to me, like always, like I'm going to pardon my French on this. The first thing they say when they walk in, I don't want to fuck up my kids. That's like number one. Some people will say, I want to save my money. But more often than not, it's going to be the first one. And so I say, if that's not what you want to do, like you have control of that. You can control what's going to happen. And I say, how do you want your kids to describe their divorce, your divorce as adults? Do you want them to say, my parents got along and I was only, you know, told, you know, which house to go to once in a while, but I had, you know, my stuff down in multiple places and everything was fine. And my parents were best friends, or you wanted to say they were at war and I couldn't like walk down the aisle together, or I couldn't, or, you know, we couldn't be at the same Sweet 16 or camp, you know, visiting day, which is happening right now. I'm having a ton of people that are coming to me for camp visiting day and they want to split the day, where they want to have another day. Like they can't be together. This morning, I just talked to a client who can't be together for one camp visiting day. And I said, all right, you know, how's your kid going to feel with the, you know, splitting a day or having like, you know, mom being pulled out the next day because, you know, mom will go now, but dad will go late. Like, it's like, I said to him, I was like, you're making your choice. But as I see it, you are choosing your own discomfort over your kids. And that's your decision to make. I was like, but just realize the decision you're making and the message you're sending your kid. So, yeah, you know, I'm like, you want to be a bad parent, go yourself. Suffice to say, I think it's, by the end of the conversation, I guilted him so much, I think he's just going to go. But he was being very, very difficult this morning. He's like, I hate her. I was like, I don't really care. I was like, but do you love your kid? I was like, is your hate for her greater than your love for your kid? Because if that's what you're saying to me.
Good point.
Okay. And no one wants to say that.
So what about that second story?
So I had another client who was, she was beautiful. I'll just start with that. Like a stunningly beautiful woman, blonde hair, blue eyed. And her husband, who was, I would say, less beautiful than her, but he, so he was really mean and he would basically make fun of the fact that she was flat chested. He would call her bored. He was just like very cruel when it came to that. So that's your backstory on who this guy was. So now fast forward, she has one young son. He is at, some sort of business conference in Las Vegas. She goes to visit him to surprise him. And she's with her son and they're sitting in the hotel room waiting for her to come back. And the phone rings and she answers it. And the woman on the phone says, you know, we're calling to ask for Mr. So-and-so. And she says, you know, he's not here right now. May I take a message? And they say, oh, well, we just want to know if he wants company tonight, similar to has, to, if he wants the same company tonight as he had yesterday. So, of course, my client's like, you know, that goes up, but she's smart. And she says, oh, well, let me, you know, I will check with him. You know, what company are you calling from? And who was he with last night so I can confirm, whatever. So she gets the information. And then sure enough, calls me a week later and says, yeah, I want to get divorced. And so, and she tells me the, you know, the name of the, I don't know, what would be the proper word to use for this? The escort service, we'll say. Yes, escort service. You know, and I, you know, you can go online and you can see. And there was this woman who was actually there. I'm sure it was her real name, whatever it was, like Candy or whatever. I'm sure it was her. So anyway, so fine. So then, but I don't bring anything up about this. My attitude is like, I'm not going there if I don't have to. It's not really the way I like to practice. But so I was like, but we'll just kind of keep it in our back pocket. So now fast forward. We're negotiating our settlement. And I remember we were in the conference room and we're like maybe, I don't know, it was like $10,000-$20,000 apart, like something pretty minimal. Actually, no, it was probably more than that now that I think about it. It was probably like closer to $50,000 apart. And this guy's just, you know, digging his heels in. He will not give it to her. And it was just one of those things. He was just honestly just being such an asshole. And this guy was like not a nice guy to begin with. So suffice it to say, I'm like, okay, in my own head, I'm like, you know, I said to her, I was like, all right, you know, I didn't want her to budge. And I say, I'm going to step out with my client. I was just like, I'm going to give you a few minutes to kind of decide if you're going to settle this case or not. And then I put a folder down. Now, the folder I had a folder the whole time, but I had put this folder down at the very, and I just let enough of the top of the paper to be out of the top of the folder that showed the name of this escort thing. Like it showed the website to show like that I obviously had the clipping of it. And it actually, I don't think it probably said her name, but it was probably just enough. And I just lay it down and I say, I'm going to step out. And so I step out and I say to my client, I have a feeling we're going to get that $50,000. And she's like, no, he's such an asshole. I was like, I'm thinking it's going to end. And so we walk back in and then sure enough, the attorney's like, she's like, he's going to agree. I said, fantastic. And so
I love this.
So then again, she comes back to see me about a year later. She moves to California, gets some surfing boyfriend, whatever, and comes back. And, you know, she walks in my office like all fancy and pretty. And all of a sudden, like, I look at her, I was like, something's different here. And she points to her chest. She's like, 25, 25. And she had gotten these enormous implants. She was beautiful. And not that she wasn't beautiful without them, but she really, it was just very, very funny. And she said, like, when she walked into him, that's what she said to him too. When he's like, what did you do? She's like, the 50,000 right here.
I love it. I love it. What a great story. And so rewarding what you do for women and being able to really, you know, empower them
and help set them up for the future. And so I love that you're doing that, that you're also partially like a therapist as well, right?
I joke I'm the most expensive therapist they've got. But I do want to say there are many men that come to me as well who also in their own way become empowered. And you know, just quickly, the one thing that I see, and this is a little sexist, but, and I think even better after COVID, but a lot of times I would have men that would come to me whom may not have been as involved in the day-to-day care giving up their children, but really wanted to be. It just wasn't their role. And they'd be almost scared to be with their children because they almost didn't know how. I mean, first of all, two-year-olds can be scary just as a whole. But like, they didn't know how to handle them. And so the things that I've seen, and very often you have people that say, oh, you know, so-and-so is such a bad father, or they don't know what's going on. They become very often, either parent becomes such a better parent when it's one-on-one because they need to learn. They need to learn, you know, what the favorite stuffed animal is. They need to learn how somebody wants their sandwich cut. And to learn the little nuances of your child strengthens that relationship. And so, I mean, I don't want to say 100% of the time, but I would say the percentages are pretty high where everybody becomes better parents sometimes after a divorce because they have to step up and learn their kid and they can't use the other parent as a crutch. And so, you know, and let's say mommy wasn't the nicest, she becomes fun mom. And there's just a lot of dynamics and everybody gets to play every role. And, you know, I'm not trying to say everybody should get divorced so you can be a better parent, but I am saying that a lot of times that people who worry about that, I've just seen it prove it not to be the case.
Yes. No, I've seen that as well. So that's a good point. So as you know, the name of my podcast is Clickline, When Everything Clicks. And so I was curious if there was a moment in your personal or professional life where things suddenly clicked and you're like, this is what it's supposed to be. It is what I'm supposed to do.
So I would say when I turned 40, which now is longer ago than I'd like to admit, but when I turned 40,
no way.
I decided that I was not going to, anytime I started with the I shoulds, I'm not going to do it. And it was a very meaningful gift I gave to myself to say, I'm at a stage in my life. I'm at a stage in my career. I'm in a stage where it's going to become much more about doing things I want to do, finding what I'm good at, being okay with the things I'm not good at because I'm good at the ones I am. It was a lot of acceptance and it was so freeing, you know, and the story I tell about this, which, you know, may or may not be funny, but my daughter was in an elementary, you know, she had an elementary events where, you know, she did little drawings and they were hanging on the wall. And there were a bunch of mothers that, you know, the mom friends who were nice enough, but I didn't really enjoy speaking to them, but they were nice. They were totally pleasant people. And so we had gone into, you know, I'd gone into the school with my daughter to look at all her pretty paintings. And as we're walking out, these mothers called me over and I really just didn't feel like talking. I just wasn't in the mood. And so I was like, nope, sorry, I gotta go. And I just took my daughter and like walked to the car. And my daughter said, she's like, well, Molly, that wasn't nice. Like, why don't you go talk to them? I was like, cause I'm 40. And I didn't want to. And I was just like, you know, because I can do what I want. And that's not how I felt like spending my time, you know? And it was one of those things. It was so freeing. And I'm not saying, you know, everyone can do that at 40. And it might be 30 when you get to do that, or it may be 50 or 60 or 80. I don't know. But there should be a time in your life where it turns around and you say, I'm going to do what is best for me. And I'm going to do what is just going to use my time, which is limited for all of us, as productively and happily as I want to. And for me, the gift I gave myself at 40 did that. And it did it in my career. It did it in all sorts of things. And yeah, I haven't looked back and I thank myself for that gift all the time.
Yes, that's amazing. I totally resonate with that because I feel the same. Once you realize and recognize what is best for yourself, then your eye, it's almost like you're looking into your life with a different lens, and then other things start to open up where you realize, oh, maybe this relationship wasn't as good, this job isn't as good for me as I thought it was, and all of these things start to kind of snowball, and then you level up and realize that you're much happier and more peaceful once you start choosing yourself first.
I agree.
Yeah,
definitely agree.
Awesome. And I have to tell you too, a funny side story. I was at an investment bank's tech conference in San Francisco a few months ago. I'm at this dinner and there's 20 ladies there, all there for the conference. And we're all talking about what we do. And I mention, you know, what I do for divorced women. And oh, yeah, by the way, I'm going to start this podcast. And I got this badass New York attorney to be on. And one lady goes, what's her name? And I said, Jacqueline Newman. And she goes, holy shit, that was my attorney.
Oh, that's so
and
funny.
I won't say her name, but I'll tell you after. But she was like, Jacqueline was so amazing. I love her. She figured out my case in like 2 months. And she was like the best person that I could have ever had and recommend for everyone. And so it was so great. That, and
oh
everyone
God,
was like,
I love
oh
that
my
you
God,
just
what
said
are
that
the
in
chances?
A way. Well, that's so nice. Yeah, I'll be very curious. And I'll have to thank her. And give her the money that I was going to pay her for that.
Yeah, it was so funny. And we're all like, no way, that's so crazy. So it was really fun.
Funny.
And so that's just a testament on how great you are that across
well,
country at a tech investment banking tech conference that you're known there. So I'm so grateful for you for being on. And thank you so much for sharing your wisdom and experience. Because, you know, a lot of people won't be able to have access, you know, to have you as their attorney and may not live in New York and things like that. So one of the main reasons why I wanted to do this podcast was to be able to help as many people as possible in providing information and helping them make better decisions.
Well, thank you for having me. I am honored to have been your first guest.
Don't forget to send in your questions and comments to the Click Line. And one more thing, the views and opinions expressed on this podcast are for informational and entertainment purposes only and should not be considered professional advice. Please consult with qualified professionals for advice related to your specific situation.